right, let me pray as well. Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for every single subject that we will look at today and that the kids will look at in the academy. Lord, as we consider philosophy, as we consider the contrast between this skeptic Hume and your servant that the kids will be studying, Jonathan Edwards, and how vast the difference is between doubting the power of being behind everything we see in this world and confessing you. So what a contrast. As it says in your Psalms, that you spoke and it stood firm. You commanded all these things and they came to be. Lord, as we look at this, I pray that you will help us to see how practical and how worship is at stake in confessing you as the power of being, that by the power of your word all things hold together. So Lord, let us be discerning as we look at this, the best thought that the unbelieving world has to offer, so we can see how paper thin it is, Lord. So burn that layer of paper thin, so-called reasoning, before our eyes. Help us to do that. Help us to see it, that we would be better thinkers and better worshipers and better evangelists. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. So the title of this one is, this is really Hume's gospel. Hume kills necessity and raises ability. That is his sacrificial death and resurrection. He kills necessity and raises probability. Three parts to the outline. First, cause and effect severed. Second, induction aborted. And then thirdly, probability as the savior. So cause and effect severed, induction aborted, and probably as the savior. Starting next week, we'll get into Hume's dialogues concerning natural religion. We'll see how this practically worked itself out in his skepticism of Christianity. Then we'll do an assessment of Hume's whole philosophy. But really, as we introduced him last week, now we're getting into the nitty-gritty, the gears, the engine of his philosophy. So it'll be the most highly technical week, I guess you could say. But if you see the problems here, you will see the problems in all atheistic and naturalistic thought thereafter. So, first, cause and effect severed. I have a picture on the board. On that picture, there is a head looking upward, two eyes. Those eyes split between cause on the left, effect on the right. So above the head in clouds, just representing the object that we are understanding to be the causal object and then the effect, the resulting object. Well, what we're going to see is that Hume, and it's really hard to explain this picture, maybe I'll take a picture of it on my iPhone or something, sort of a triangle coming from his eyes, because it's then split upward, kind of like an upside-down pyramid. So experience is the inner triangle. That's what Hume's going to land on. It's a dotted line, and so it's not certain. It's experience. He's going to say, we understand cause and effect by experience. Now, on the outside of the triangle, coming all the way down from the heavens through those two clouds of cause and effect in pink, are arrows coming into his head, and that's reason. That's us understanding cause and effect by reason, and therefore we understand there to be a necessary connection between cause and effect. In other words, there's actually a formal principle of cause and effect that is as formal and as necessary as the laws of logic, given a world where there's a succession of things and stuff like that. So cause and effect is a necessary law. Well, Hume's going to deny that. So you see X's through the arrows of reason. Okay, so he's going to cut off the necessary connection of cause and effect. He's going to say, so this is where we actually get it from, through experience. So let's work that out. That's the picture. No sooner does Hume come away with some feeling of triumph in vindicating empiricism, and that's what we looked at last week, that he introduces us to the first of the problems that he is unwittingly going to bring to empiricism. So the first Humean difficulty to empiricism, in other words, a difficulty that Hume himself introduces in the act of trying to defend empiricism, Hume actually strikes a significant blow against empiricism, and it leads him to skepticism. The first Humean difficulty to empiricism is the problem of ascribing causality. He begins by saying that, quote, all reasonings concerning matter of fact seem to be founded on the relation of cause and effect. So he has his problems with theology, his problems with metaphysics and the scholastics. He's, in his mind, he's cleared the ground. And so now he's going to start building his own system. But he says, all reasonings, in other words, everything I'm about to say, everything I'm about to build, concerning matter of fact, seem to be founded on the relation of cause and effect, end quote. Could say it like this. I'm an atheist. I'm a naturalist. Everything I'm about to tell you that's not pink unicorns like you is founded on the relationship of cause and effect. Now, it's important to note that he calls it the relation of cause and effect for a reason, because Hume had felt unfairly criticized in his day for denying the reality of cause and effect. He denied this charge. Rather, he said, it is our knowledge of their relationship in each particular case that I'm denying. I'm not denying that every effect has to have a cause. I'm saying that we cannot discern the particular relationship in each particular case. The problem is the supposed connection between the present fact and that which is inferred from it. So one of the famous examples is the rooster crowing and the sunrise. And we see the connection, and we infer, or the cue ball hitting into the eight ball. We see one constantly associated with the other, and we infer the connection. Well, if that's suspect, if there's no necessary relationship between any two facts, however closely associated they are with each other, in particular instances, how then do we arrive at the knowledge of cause and effect if not from their necessary relationship? Well, he sets forth a general proposition. He says this, quote, that the knowledge of this relationship is not in any instance, that's important, in any, he's talking about anything, the knowledge of this relationship is not in any instance attained by reasonings a priori. He's not saying your brain's not operative. He's saying that the reasoning you're employing about the relationship is not a formal or necessary relationship, but arises entirely from experience. When we find that any particular objects are constantly conjoined with each other. So that sentence is this diagram. We do not know the relationship between cause and effect because of an actual necessary relationship between any two particular things, but we derive them from experience. We constantly see these things going together. To say it another way, causes and effects are discoverable not by reason, but by experience. So right there, sort of rewind to Locke. Not by reason, but by experience. So Locke in empiricism separates sensory stimuli from reason, which is immediately should be a red flag. That's why as a book-reading sentient being, I couldn't take atheism seriously. Because I have to separate stimuli from reason. I have to be a plant to buy it. Okay, so it validates itself, but it's complex as to how it does that. But just notice that at first. We derive cause and effect not by reason, but by experience. He argues for this roughly the same way as he did in the case of the man filling out the missing shade of color on that spectrum from last week. Remember, we were in the paint store, and we say, what if there was one missing in all that blue? And how does he construct that? Is it from reasoning a priori, or is he a posteriori from the shades that are already there, from stimuli, then just fill in that next gradation? Well, he argues this pretty much the same way, and he takes Adam back in the Garden of Eden as his case study. Quote, Adam, though his rational faculties be supposed, at the very first, entirely perfect, could not have inferred from the fluidity and transparency of water that it would suffocate him, or from the light and warmth of fire that it would consume him, end quote. So Adam could not have, nor could any human being coming onto the scene, maybe with full reasoning capacities as an adult, infer suffocation from water simply from its fluidity and stuff like that, or being consumed by fire simply from its light and so forth and so on. He has to build up to that by experience. So it's just a typical empiricist argument. And so at this point, Hume has followed the empiricist John Locke, and I would say he's even followed rationalists like Descartes in reducing the objective epistemological question. In other words, how do you know? How do you know that you know that there's a necessary connection between cause and effect? Well, he would say, we don't know that there's a necessary connection between cause and effect. It arises, the idea arises. So what does he just do to epistemology? Same thing Descartes did with rationalism, same thing Locke did with empiricism. He's reduced the objective epistemological question, how do you know that you know, back down to how do you know? And what he means by that is, how did Adam know? Or how did your friend come to know that? Where did you get that idea from? Well, when I was a baby, I touched things, if hot, then ow, and color, and stuff like that. In other words, the question of how do you know becomes, tell me your journey. Tell me about how you constructed from primary colors and hot stoves to the entire world that you understand it right now. So epistemology in the Enlightenment, whether from the rationalist or the empiricist, turns inward and starts to become speaking about myself, my feelings, my journey. That's not objective thought. That's not tough-minded reason. And so Hume is just at this last point where he's going to kill the whole thing. Locke reduced necessary ideas to innate ideas, such that if he could go to the carnival and knock down the pins labeled innate ideas, he would win the prize of having destroyed necessary a priori ideas. But that is a confusion of language. Likewise, in this case, Hume is reducing Adam's access to universal truths to his incapacity to infer drowning from fluidity and to infer consumption from the flame. He learns everything he learns from experience, from trial and error, or at least observation of more remote happenings. And so Hume has ruled out the question of whether or not we can know actual objective truth. Everything has been reduced to constructing, back to Locke, the Lego pieces, a posteriori, the opposite of rationalism. But as with Locke, so with Hume, it does not follow. Hume commits the non sequitur fallacy here. So to Locke, it does not follow that just because necessary ideas are not innate, in other words, they don't come with the package at birth, that therefore no ideas are necessary, or that they cannot be grasped as such afterwards, after you're born. Well, it's same thing with Hume. It does not follow that just because we came to discover the link between cause and effect by experiencing a succession of events, that therefore the link is not necessary. Hume's argument is because it arises that way, if touch stove, therefore ow, and you build that up from toddlerhood onto adulthood, it doesn't follow that therefore there is no necessary connection. And that's his whole argument so far. But he's persistent. And so he drags out various examples of scientific surprises. In other words, phenomena that we could never have concluded by a priori arguments. And that would make a fine corrective to rationalism, but Hume is absolutely sure that he's also knocking down all the metaphysical speculation of the scholastics. And this is relevant to modern physics as it began to be conceived in the 20th century. I'm going to introduce a Hume word into our lexicon here. Let's call the constant surface appearance of the connection between cause and effect by the word custom. So this plane right here, as I experience it, Hume has a word for that. He calls it custom. We keep seeing this. We keep seeing the white ball rolling and the eight ball rolling. We keep seeing the sun rise and hearing the rooster crow. We keep seeing that, and so we're associating it, and we'll call that line of constantly seeing it on the surface custom. That's the word Hume uses. But let's not confuse custom with necessity, because Hume is rejecting that. Hume says this, And as the first imagination or invention of a particular effect in all natural operations is arbitrary, where we consult not experience, so must we also esteem the supposed tie or connection between the cause and effect which binds them together and renders it impossible that any other effect could result from the operation of that cause. So Hume is, in metaphysically, he's rejecting the idea that if you throw a rock at a window pane, that it simply cannot turn into a bouquet of flowers. Okay? He's rejecting the idea that each particular cause must give you a particular effect or a particular range of effects. Now, Hume's a realist in the new modern sense of the word, so he's saying, now we have other reason to not expect that, but there's no necessary connection between any particular cause and any particular effect. And so it sounds a lot like quantum physics, sort of the ultimate scientific model of expecting the unexpected. But Hume is really drawing a more general inverse relationship between a priori reasoning and a posteriori reasoning. So let's put up here in necessary connection what he means by a priori reasoning is truth, assumption, general truths that I simply accept and put the arrow coming, keep coming down here prior to experience. Must be the case, so I'm going to impose that on the data. Hume is exalting a posteriori reasoning. Now, again, in Christian thought, it's not one versus the other. Okay? You have mathematical and logical thinking and scientific thinking going together, but the order matters. Hume is rejecting a priori thinking, except for all the sentences he uses, which employ a priori, and we'll come back to that. There's a funny, triumphant, suicidal statement at the end of this book that Hume is famously hung for by all people that see it. But anyway, we'll get to that. The idea here is that a priori claims to necessary truth have a tendency to hinder scientific advance. If I assume that rule, if I assume that dogma, then I can't expect to observe other things. These a priori truths rule out any other explanation but themselves. Well, no doubt that is a feature of faulty human reasoning. There are many a priori commitments within worldviews that have disallowed evidence which is contrary to the dogma of that particular system. That is a problem, no doubt about it. But I would say that Hume is swinging his axe way down close to the roots of thought when a chainsaw to a couple of branches would have done just fine. Is the a priori nature of necessary truth per se the great hindrance to scientific advancement? Hume would say yes. Later philosophers of science, not believers, would disagree with him. They would say no. Hume gives his reader, now we're going to get into the actual problem that he presents for empiricism. Hume gives his reader a moment of transparency. I'm going to read you a paragraph here, and this paragraph perfectly demonstrates the problem with Hume's thoughts in Hume's own words. He gives you a rare moment of transparency, and he has to. He has to clarify the foundation of his system. So here's what he does, and there's going to be a progression of three things. And in these three things, he's going to say, this is the foundation. But you know what? Somebody could ask, well, what's the foundation of that? So here's how Hume says it. Quote, when it is asked, what is the nature of all of our reasonings concerning matter of fact? The proper answer seems to be that they are founded on the relation of cause and effect. So far, Hume, what's the foundation of all of our thought about real things? Hume's answer, it seems to be the necessary connection between cause and effect. The very thing he's trying to slay here. So he's saying, that seems to be the foundation. He continues, when again it is asked, what is the foundation of all our reasonings and conclusions concerning that relation? It may be replied in one word, experience. But if we still carry our sifting humor and ask, what is the foundation of all conclusions from experience? This implies a new question, which may be of more difficult solution and explication. And answering that third question is where Hume is going to kill his own empiricist thinking. So this is a good start, a good moment of clarity for Hume. But before we go too fast, we need to see that Hume is hitching the wagon of all science and ethics. What he's about to kill is his own view. Not that science and ethics belong to him, but remember, he's an Enlightenment person, he's a skeptic. It's pretty clear that he believes nature is all there is. And so he's going to try to provide a foundation for science and ethics. And he's going to hitch the wagon of science and ethics, as he sees it, to the star of whatever his answer is going to be to this question. Remember, what is the foundation for all of our conclusions about experience? The first answer he gives is negative. He says, quote, that even after we have experience of the operations of cause and effect, our conclusions from that experience are not founded on reasoning or any process of the understanding, end quote. So he confesses that nature shows us only the surface of objects and not the real powers and principles behind it. So let me add some more Hume-like words so you know the lexicon. He is admitting that this is the surface of what we see, what Aristotle would have called locomotion versus sort of ultimate motion. So this is the surface. This is what we see in this world. Above, on the surface, on the cover of the subatomic level, we see local motion. That's the surface. Behind this, there are what he would call the powers and the principles. So put one, powers, two, principles up here in the sphere of necessary connection. We don't see these. It takes reason to see those, and we don't. This gives you a clue as to how this leads completely naturally right into Kant. But at any rate, this idea of cause and effect is not based on reasoning or real understanding, but by experience. We don't see the powers and the principles behind this apparent motion. But this presents two difficulties of which Hume seems oblivious. Number one, what is the nature of even those surface objects? So right back to Locke's difficulty with primary versus secondary qualities. What is the nature of even those surface objects? You can't even answer that. And then secondly, these real powers and principles, would these be those very metaphysical powers and principles whose reality you deny? So physics describes the surface motion, how things move when they move. Yet we presume upon the secret power that maintains the whole motion. Hume seems to understand that Aquinas was right. And yet he's saying it to mean the opposite, that he was wrong. What is the power? Tell me, Hume, you're denying its existence. And while you're at it, can you even tell me what the nature is of things on the surface? Okay, so what's going on there is he is in this massive denial. There should have been good enough philosophers to sit him down in the chair as a psychiatrist would a patient. But there weren't good enough philosophers. There was one, but he was across the pond. His name was Jonathan Edwards, and apparently Hume wasn't reading him say the exact opposite. What is really meant by our ignorance of this underlying power or necessary connection? Well, let's remember how Hume says our ideas begin. Remember last week, how do our ideas begin? What's the 101 of Hume's empiricism? Impressions. Impressions. And so remember the thing from last week. Let's see. I don't want to put it on this board. So Locke had one assembly line going this way. Sensation was the primary cause going this way. Hume just added a second one with passion from the inside, from my heart. Both could be represented by a fire. Fire is what we used last week. And the reason we use fire is because it's very picturesque to show us that Hume's emphasis is on the strength of the impression. So, what is more lively? What is more real? The impressions. Number one, impressions. In here, number two, ideas. Ideas are just the sort of the echo, the faint effect. Effect? We don't know the relationship between cause and effect. Uh-oh. Looks like Hume's doubt of cause and effect is going to destroy Hume's assembly line, too. One more contradiction. Hume is a mass of contradictions. No one more brilliantly wove himself in contradictions like David Hume, and more famously. So, impressions. So, Hume, is there any impression of a causal relation? So all of our ideas are constructed by impressions. Do we have an impression of a causal relationship? So there I'm not talking about this object, which is A, and this object, which is B. They are on their own. The question is there a third object, namely the relationship, the real relationship between them? Is that an impression? Hume would say, not at all. There are only the sum of impressions, each as infinitely divisible as the numbers on that number line. Here's one more way to say it. If there is any object that may be called the power by which any A causes B. So let's put these numbers up there. Numbers. Hello. A. Let's put... I put 1 and 2 before, but A and B. So I'm going to put A for cause, B for effect. And the question... That's why I put numbers. Numbers are better here. Because my question is there a third object? So let's put 1 by cause, 2 on effect. Is there a third object, namely the relation, the actual causing between cause and effect? Is there impression like that? Humans say, no. If there is any object that can be called the power by which any A causes any B, it can never be discovered by reason, any more than it can be observed from an impression from nature. We never take in idea A and idea B. Okay? So we never take them in as ideas. Remember, we have to take them in as impressions. The idea comes after. We never take in the impression, and philosophers use the word percept A and percept B, because they have to come up with a word that can stand in for the forming of the idea. We never take those things in wholly. So one later empiricist of sorts, Bertrand Russell, says what we really do, and what Hume's really saying, is that we really combine percept A and the idea of B together. Because when you're watching, we just played pool last night, when you're watching the cue ball go into the eight ball, you never see the moment, you see this. You say, what are you talking about, Matt? You see the moment of the, do you? On the number line? What is that moment? What is that? It's the strike, it's the giving up of the velocity, it's the rotation, any physical aspect of it, and you'll never be able to say what that object is as something that's an actual impression. And on that point, I agree completely with Hume, I agree completely with Russell, and I would say that is your problem to explain. I don't have that problem. Because I can explain metaphysically what that is. They're the ones that have cut their heads off at this point. Why then do we find so much agreement on what causes what? Why do we live in a world in which we all can speak about, hey, that was the cause of that? Here's his answer. It's because the constant conjunction of the two, B following A, the constant conjunction of B following A leads our minds to the association of the two objects. But we are never, ever given anything new in the objects themselves. We are only being trained toward what he calls custom. So, over here, let's replace relation, because if there is some, we don't see it. We don't see the relation. We don't reason about the relationship. We are cut off from the relationship between the cause and the effect. What we are left with is an association. By the constant conjunction, let's put constant conjunction or connection, but he doesn't want to say connection because that's too logically, and he doesn't want to admit that. The constant conjunction, I constantly see the ball hitting the ball and so on, and I constantly see that, and so I associate A and B. I associate these, and I'll call them, by custom, I will call them cause and effect. Am I starting to see the problem with this?
Isn't he denying induction?
He's denying induction, he's denying science, he's denying everything he's saying. He's taking back with the left hand what he's giving with the right, and so on and so forth. He's cutting off the feet under his legs, tearing off the ground under his feet. But here's what he does. The idea of experience saves the day. I'll click my heels together, and I will follow the whatever brick road, and we'll just say there's no place like experience. That's what Locke does, experience. Experience stands in the place of this ignorance. Now, it is extremely odd, extremely ironic, that Hume taught 2.5 centuries of tough-minded people to do with the word experience what they've always accused Christians of doing with the ideas of revelation and miracles and mystery. In other words, experience became the empiricists' god of the gaps. The word they just insert into the gap that they're telling you, I have no idea what's there. Where?
anywhere. That's tough-minded? That's your reason for saying what we're saying is pink unicorns? That's the whole thing? Yeah.
Induction aborted. So you saw it. Induction aborted. Here's the first death. Well, we just saw the whole thing, but let's just do a freeze frame and let's dissect it. Let's do a little iPhone thing and let's get in there and see what starts to collapse. First of all, induction aborted. This is our second point, induction aborted. The first problem leads directly to the second. Without a necessary connection between particular causes and particular effects, we are left to presume the relationship by experience or custom. So Hume, what do you mean by experience? I mean I'm going to assume that the cue ball really hits the eight ball. I'm going to assume that the rooster has something to do with the sunrise. I'm going to assume it. So you see exactly how Hume leads to Kant. I'm going to assume it. And that being the case, the relationship between experience and prediction is severed along with it. If I eliminate the connection between real cause and real effect, in other words, the being, the necessary relationship between this particular cause and a particular range of effects, if I sever that connection, well, then I also sever the connection between experience and prediction. So let's put over here one more word. I'll put a 1 by experience and a 2 by prediction, which is, of course, it's a staple of science, right? I don't know how to say, I'll break it or something, barbed wire, I don't know. You get the idea. I am severing the connection between experience and prediction. If I cut your head off, your eyes are disconnected from your hands too, right? And so if I sever the connection between cause and effect in terms of real being, I'm going to sever the connection between experience and prediction. I can't believe in science. Why? Remember, their reason for disbelieving in God, pink unicorns, is science, but they actually can't believe in science either. And here is why. The relationship between experience and prediction is severed. Hume says this, quote, "As to past experience, it can be allowed to give direct and certain information of those precise objects only, and that precise period of time which fell under its cognizance. But why this experience should be extended to future times and to other objects, which for all we know, may be only in appearance similar. This is the main question on which I would insist. The consequence seems nowise necessary." If I can't see the connection between this and this, then I have no reason to believe that the same thing that I'm associating will happen tomorrow. I have no reason. I've given no reason why they're connected over here. I have no reason to tell you why the sun tomorrow won't just start dancing and fly off into space and the whole universe and solar system implode. No reason. Later empiricists, their argument against Hume at this point is simply, come on. That's their whole argument. What are you talking about? I can show you 40 pages worth of, show me the 40 pages. I will show you how those 40 pages are saying nothing but, it's just a hissy fit. It'll be a 40-page hissy fit, I promise you. Bring it to me. Okay? So, never mind his highly dubious usage of the adjectives direct and certain about these objects of experience. For just a moment, here's what matters. What matters is that inductive reasoning is in trouble. And that spells the death of science. Hume recognizes the inference that we all make. We all basically say about objects past, objects future, we all basically say two things. Number one, I have found that such an object has always been attended with such an effect. Sunrise, rooster, cue ball, eight ball, doesn't matter. I have found that rock in the window, breaking window. I have found that such an object has always been attended with such an effect. Two, I foresee that other objects which are in appearance similar will be attended with similar effects. When I threw the baseball that way at that window pane, it broke. Therefore, I will assume that things that are hard like that and can be projected like that will break similar window pane looking thingies. Okay, those are the two premises. I have seen, therefore I foresee. I have seen, therefore I foresee.
Hume says that the connection between these two propositions is neither intuitive nor proven. I have seen this. I foresee this. It's similar. Hume is saying that these two propositions, the connection between them, is neither intuitive nor proven. And I will certainly agree that they are not proven. But that's your problem. Okay, we'll get back to that. And yet, its necessity seems to be the origin of all our conclusions concerning matter of fact. Hume knows that he's in deep waters here. Hume knows that he has a problem. I need a science and I need a world that is tougher than your pink unicorns in the Middle Ages. And he must call it that to ignore the fact that he's got something a little bit more unintelligible than pink unicorns. A lot more. He knows it, he senses it, and he's saying it seems like the necessary connection between these two things is the foundation to everything I want to put in its place. But there is no necessary connection. More famous is the way that Hume gave the problem of induction its final expression. So, with the problem of causation comes the problem, let's do dominoes, of induction. So let's do this. It's a falling domino, trust me. And we'll call this first falling domino the problem of causation. Let's call necessary causation, that's better. Problem of necessary causation. And let's put dot, 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 and this is another falling domino, trust me. Two, let's call it problem of induction. So far in Hume's worldview, the problem of necessary causation has fallen, and we are noting that it's knocking into the domino of induction, and it's going to lead right to this problem. We can call the problem of induction, if you want, if it helps, the all swans are white problem. All swans are white. Type A statement, universal affirmative. All swans are white. Question. What would you need in order to vindicate the universal truth that all swans are white? What would you need? You would need omniscience, wouldn't you? I would dare say you'd need omnipresence. You'd have to be ever. That's silly. There's no swans in planet. Wait a minute. The more I say that and think about it, the more I realize I have no real ground to say that. No, you don't. You would need omniscience. Since only one counterexample, one black swan, falsifies the statement, we would have to ensure that no such examples could ever be. So all you would need to contradict the universal affirmative all swans are white is one counterexample, some swan is not white, type O statement. Simply stated, the problem of induction is this. I don't want to put this on the board, it's a little bit, it's the most concise way I could say it. I wanted to put in the Academy Dictionary, I just couldn't get there yet. I'm pretty sure there's a more concise way to say it, but I know it's accurate, so here it is. The problem of induction is this. Here's my definition. The conclusion of universal truths from particular observations without, because science does that. Science makes general rules from particular observations. General rules, that's different. There's still a class, there's still a circle where it's appropriate to draw a circle because it's not infinite. The conclusion of universal truths from particular observations without, now you're treating science like logic, without a demonstrably necessary connection between them. When Hume knocks over the domino of necessary connection, he has to knock over the problem of induction. It wasn't just this annoying Scottish guy that brought up this stuff that we don't want to think about. Hume was honest, more honest at least, than his admirers. He knew that the problem of necessary causation necessarily caused, irony sold separately, the problem of induction. So what's the problem of induction? Well, here's a little circle, and I'm going to observe white swans. And rather than say, as a general principle, I'm working on the scientific model of white swans everywhere, we leap from science to confusing science and logic and saying, all swans are, and here's what we mean, necessarily white. Now, in language, of course, we could have invented the word swan to mean only that which is a white bird. We could have done that and said, well, that just is what that is. That's not what we're talking about, though. We're saying on an empirical, observational, inductive level, all swans are white. Meaning, as I have seen, Eliphaz said about Job, every time I see suffering, sin is the cause. Premise 2, Job is suffering, therefore Job is sinning. Remember that? Christian karma by induction. Okay? So that's the problem of induction in a nutshell. It is confused about its own omniscience. The person who commits the problem of induction at some point mistook science for omniscience, omniscience, made the leap. Not a problem with induction. We love induction. There's nothing wrong with induction. The problem of induction is that you're equivocating on induction. Difficult to state the problem more concisely than that. I'm working on it a little bit, but Hume himself was driven to this problem. That's the important point. So to review, we have a couple of presuppositions behind this problem. Number one, that the future will be conformable to the past. In other words, past experience. And then, following from that, all arguments from experience are founded on the similarity which we discover among natural objects, is Hume's exact words, and by which we are induced to expect effects similar to those which we have found to follow from such objects. So, put together, Hume's words also, this is a more concise way to say it, quote, from causes which appear similar, we expect similar effects. Not surprisingly, the dead body of science in Hume's trunk is not really his concern. Instead, he's much more interested in beating his chest over the inability of any branch of human knowledge to stop the bleeding. The closest thing to his own logical armor is to remind us that, quote, whatever is intelligible and can be distinctly conceived implies no contradiction and can never be proved false by any demonstrative argument or abstract reasoning a priori, end quote. In other words, ignore the dead body of science in my trunk, ignore the fact that my whole worldview is up in flames, you can't do any better. That's his argument at this point. He assumes the argument for God from back when, from the scholastics, he assumes that natural theology, the cosmological argument, the ontological argument, and so forth, he assumes that the arguments for God are arguments a priori against things. Remember, he said that you can't show a contradiction about any particular thing. He is assuming that the arguments for God, a priori, which is an a priori assumption on his part, another contradiction. You'll see millions of them in Hume. Everywhere he walks, there's another of his own contradictions. He is assuming up front that the arguments for God are arguments against particular things. Au contraire, our arguments for God are arguments against your square circles, non-things. All right. So his argument at this point is, since nobody can do any better than induction, since nobody can be talking about real being except by induction, then I will ignore the fact that I've just killed induction. My triumph of metaphysical skepticism is absolutely complete. Bertrand Russell, atheist, 20th century, would later remark that, quote, this led Hume to certain skeptical conclusions which are equally difficult to refute and to accept, end quote. So Russell's own hiccup of honesty, Hume brought us to the place where he said a bunch of things that are difficult to refute, but difficult to accept. In fact, Russell went on to summarize Hume's whole doctrine in two parts, and this is telling. Russell says, quote, Hume's doctrine has two parts. Number one, when we say A causes B, all that we have a right to say is that in past experience, A and B have frequently appeared together or in rapid succession. And no instance has been observed of A not followed by or accompanied by B. Two, however many instances we have observed of the conjunction of A and B, that gives no reason for expecting them to be conjoined on a future occasion, though it is a cause of this expectation. Or, here's another way Russell more concisely summarizes those two doctrines of Hume. And he's going to agree with the first, and he's going to disagree with the second. Number one, in causation, there is an indefinable relationship except conjunction or succession. So doctrine one of Hume is right here. See, remember one, experience. We have no reason to believe there's a necessary connection between any particular cause and any particular effect.
Secondly, therefore, we have no reason to expect any of those things to be so in the future. Russell follows it, and he says, I understand what he means by the first, but I cannot accept the second. Russell does not argue against Hume. He tries. But he's an empiricist. He needs it. Hume, at least, was pompous enough about his own mind and ramblings to not care that he was actually killing his own worldview. He so wanted to hear himself talk. Guys like Bertrand Russell needed naturalism, apparently, more than Hume, and so he was a little more dishonest about it. So Russell goes on to say, quote, empiricists in general, in other words, since Hume, have accepted the first of the theses and rejected the second. In other words, I accept your problem with necessary causation. I reject it must lead to the problem of induction. That's what Russell's saying. In other words, to maintain the empiricist's sinking ship, one has to ignore the problem of induction, to not really grapple with it. And without getting too much into final assessments of Hume, we'll do that in the next couple weeks, let me just add one more inference by Russell, that, quote, if the first half of Hume's doctrine is admitted, the rejection of induction makes all expectations as to the future irrational, even the expectation that we shall continue to feel expectations. So Russell realizes that if Hume is right, it's not theology that dies. It's Hume that dies. It's Russell that dies. It's everything the modern world puts its faith in which dies. So Russell is right that Hume is wrong. We do have an expectation that the sun will rise tomorrow. But Russell's being more dishonest than Hume about the ground of that expectation. Because Hume is being honest and saying, if that is true, we don't have any necessary knowledge about science, the foundation of science. And Russell's saying, I can't accept that. Now, one other 20th century philosopher of science even said, I love this quote, that induction is the glory of science and the scandal of philosophy. So picture Schaefer's staircase. Philosophy on the top, and it's modern philosophy. And they know that they've got themselves a contradiction. They've got an A equals non-A over here. They've got a necessary relationship, our foundation of all our knowledge. There's a necessary relationship, but no, there isn't. Philosophy at the top floor, the witch doctors understand that the Enlightenment philosophy didn't work. It's incoherent. But guess what? The train's already left the station. Hitler's already gassing up the ovens. They're already inflating the currency. They need this to be true. They need Darwinism to be true. They need all these things to be true. So we're just going to, down here at the third step of science, we're just going to ignore the problem of induction. We're going to picture them, you know, doing this up the stairs. Talk to the hand. You know, picture them. And most scientists just don't even see it at all. It's more the philosophers of science that are trying to protect the bubble. Okay? Induction is the glory of science and the scandal of philosophy. Au contraire, again, in Christian philosophy, it's not a scandal at all. It has a place. Its place is inside of deduction. Its place is inside of systematic theology. And therefore, it works. It's only a problem for you. Well, probability as the savior. Let's round out Hume's gospel. How is induction safe from its own uncertainty? He's already divided legitimate knowledge into deductive and mathematical on the one hand. In other words, logical truth like A equals A. If A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. That's mathematical, deductive, logical. And on the other hand, matter of fact. It is the latter that is about real being. And that's where he's concerned that there is no certainty. Only logic and mathematics gives you certainty, but that's not about real stuff. Empiricism, that's real stuff. But there's no certainty. So I have a dilemma. And in Hume's way of thinking, even the analytical side of truth is suspect because it has to pass through our reasoning. And so it's going to suffer the same fate. It's interesting that in his earlier treatise, he considers a math problem, he checks its results, and then he says, when I proceed still farther to turn the scrutiny against every successive estimation I make of my faculties, all the rules of logic require a continual diminution, a total extinction of belief and evidence. So he's right back to Descartes. He's saying, even math, I can get my math reasoning wrong. So reason itself, math or logic, is certain in itself, but I can be wrong in my tabulations. I could be wrong in my reasoning. And so if you check your work, if you ask, well, what's the foundation of that?
What's the foundation of that? You can never find it. You can never stop the bleeding. Every instance of reasoning contains the empirical dimension. And so what stops the skeptical bleeding for Hume is nature herself. Nature herself. What is the stopgap? What stops this? What's the dam of these floods of doubt? Nature is like a relentless shore against the constant waves of doubt. And so Hume's answer to this is very pragmatic. He's just going to ignore it. He's going to stop asking questions. Nature herself. No one can really go out into the sea of skepticism and be happy and live, and that's true. But that's his ultimate answer. On the solid ground of nature, we can ignore the waves of skepticism. But deep down inside, Hume knew that he needed something more than this pragmatic dismissal. And so now he's going to build probability. He didn't invent it. I'm saying he's going to assert it as the solution here. In another place, Hume is going to have to assume a third principle, the uniformity of nature. So let's put up here, I don't know if this is even the right place for this domino, I just know it's going to fall. So, the uniformity of nature. Normally this wouldn't go here necessarily. It's actually going to be a foundation. But it's just the order of his thinking. He has to insert it. He's going to insert, it's going to be his miracle. Let's just draw an arrow. It's going to cut in here. He has to insert the uniformity of nature. Now, let me add one more picture, and the picture is going to be about a house. At the foundation of the house, let's put uniform nature. Say, what does this have to do with probability? Just hold on. Hold on to your hats. Okay? Uniform nature, and then from uniform nature, we have experience. But I'm not going to draw the walls and the roof yet. I'm just going to draw, as walls, two question marks. Because he's not going to get very far in his building. The floods came and the rains came and all that stuff while they're still building. It just didn't work out. Okay? Now, he's going to want to assert from experience probability. So probability is going to be the savior, but how does he do it? He has to assume uniform nature, that nature is always going on. As the name suggests, the uniformity of nature, this is the idea that nature is uniform, that it exhibits a basic level of order, enough order to make reliable predictions. So future's like the past, that over there is like this over here. But the question is, how so, given his problem of induction? Here's his dilemma about the uniformity of nature, given the problem of induction. He's got a dilemma. Either he will have to resurrect inductive reasoning by some other principle than certainty, because that's the problem of induction. It doesn't give you certainty. Or else, he will have to simply assume the principle of the uniformity of nature up front. In other words, he's going to have to take it on faith. If induction is suspect by rooting everything in experience, so is the more general principle of the uniformity of nature. C.S. Lewis, in his book on miracles, devotes an entire page to this problem in Hume. And so here's Lewis addressing the issue. Quote, and as you hear this quote, look at the house that never becomes a house. It never gets a roof, never gets walls, as you listen to Lewis's words. Quote, there's also an objection to Hume which leads us deeper into our problem. The whole idea of probability, as Hume understands it, depends on the principle of the uniformity of nature. So far, Lewis is seeing my house, and he sees that is accurate. I'm graphically demonstrating what Lewis is saying. It depends on the principle of the uniformity of nature. Unless nature always goes on in the same way, the fact that a thing happened 10 million times would not make it a whit more probable that it would happen again. And thought shows us that we do not know it by experience. In other words, we don't know all swans are white by experience. We observe many regularities in nature, but of course all the observations that men have made or will make while the race lasts cover only a minute fraction of the events that actually go on. Our observations would therefore be of no use since we felt sure that nature, when we are not watching her, behaves in the same way as when we are. In other words, unless we believed in the uniformity of nature. So, experience, predictability, depends on the uniformity of nature in this idea. So Lewis continues, and here's the clunker, here's the kicker. He says, experience, therefore, cannot prove uniformity. Because uniformity has to be assumed before experience proves anything. And mere length of experience does not help matters. It is no good saying each fresh experience confirms our belief in uniformity, and therefore we reasonably expect that it will always be confirmed. For that argument works only on the assumption that the future will resemble the past, which is simply the assumption of uniformity under a new name. So, if I believe that the future will resemble the past and I'm not in the future, I'm operating on the assumption of the uniformity of nature. I can't use it to prove the uniformity of nature. That's what Lewis is saying. Can we say, Lewis continues, that uniformity is at any rate very probable? Unfortunately not. We have just seen that all probabilities depend on it. Unless nature is uniform, nothing is either probable or improbable. And clearly, the assumption that you have to make before there is any such thing as probability cannot itself be probable. The odd thing is, Lewis finishes, the odd thing is that no man knew this better than Hume. His essay on miracles is quite inconsistent with the more radical and honorable skepticism of his main work, end quote. So, what Lewis is saying, and he accurately represents, almost word for word, everything Hume admits. I can't prove the uniformity of nature either from experience, because that was depending on this. Well, can I say that the uniformity of nature is at least probable? No, because I have to assume it to plug things into my probability quotients. And so Hume has to just accept the uniformity of nature on faith. Now, the whole foundation to Hume's argument against miracles is going to be on the uniformity of nature. Okay? So this is very, very, very important to remember. We'll come back to it next week and the week after. Immediate catch. And this is one thing that Hume was refreshingly honest about. Hume goes on to say, quote, probability, so this will show you that Lewis was not misunderstanding Hume. Hume says, quote, probability is founded on the presumption of a resemblance between those objects of which we have had experience and those of which we have had none. And therefore, it is impossible that this presumption can arise from probability. The foundation of probability cannot arise from probability. Then I would be arguing in a circle. Now, Hume realizes that would be circular reasoning, but he goes on to do it anyway. Very interesting. In my notes, I break that down into a five-premise argument, which I don't have time to get into, but I will give the notes to anybody that wants it to show that. But in a reductio ad absurdum argument, we could take either horn of the dilemma. If the presumption behind probability is necessary truth, if you want to leave this behind, you want to stay a naturalist, but you want to abandon Hume's way of thinking about this, let's say that you want to say that, well, probability is necessary. Okay, well, you've got two problems then. Because if probability is based on necessary truth, then it would appear, number one, that necessary truth is back, which is what you wanted to reject, and that, B, necessary truth is the foundation for probable truth, that necessary things are more real than probable things, which you want to reject that too. Okay? Now, if, on the other hand, the presumption behind probability is unknown, then it follows that there's going to emerge an infinite regress of probability, holding up each other probable reason for each and every assertion. So-called probable truth is like quicksand. The more one's desire for certainty begins to squirm around for a ground in probability, the more he will sink into the depths of uncertainty. So think of it this way. A single probable truth, if you're an atheist, is like one of those tortoises in the ancient story where the world is supported and is rooted on an infinite stack of tortoises in space. Each probable truth is like that. There's no end. It just goes on forever. And that's uncertainty. Now, none of this has any practical consequence for Hume or the people that love him. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that it's a mass of contradictions. It doesn't matter that it doesn't work. We just do continue to learn. We just do continue to improve life by inductive reasoning and on the principle of probability. Well, you're assuming that the Christian worldview doesn't have inductive reasoning or the principle of probability. We do, we just have a real foundation for it. So, two other basic defenses of induction have been made since Hume's time. I'll end with this. Bertrand Russell and the positivists in the 20th century noted that sure, probability is not certainty, but we attain such high degrees of probability for many things that its remaining levels of uncertainty are absolutely negligible. So in other words, there's such a high degree of probability about some things that it's as good as certainty. It's like the same thing. Since there's no such thing anyway, we'll call it the same thing. Okay? A lesser-known 20th century philosopher, David Stove, argued that from statistics, we could see the regular pattern of subsets conforming to the larger classes to which they belong. And so it's unreasonable to persist in doubting such patterns that always show up. Well, these arguments both seem to be variations of what their forerunner Hume had already argued. The difference is that Hume elsewhere contradicted these and was honest about it at different places where these guys are simply not. Incredibly, to end, Hume went so far to say that, quote, there is no object which implies the existence of any other, if we consider these objects in themselves, and never look beyond the ideas which we form of them. So back to the cosmic popcorn machine, that sure, there never could have been a time when there was nothing, but that doesn't mean there has to be anything necessarily. It may be that there was always enough things that just kept popping into existence. Okay, where's your kernels? Where's your oil? Where's your heat source? That's just a basic way to say, really? Nothing is necessary? There's no single thing that's necessary? Well, of course, there was never back to the argument against Edwards. If you want to pick up Edwards' private notebooks on being and say, no, you're making a leap, Edwards. You're saying that no thing is impossible. Nothing is impossible. It is impossible to conceive of nothingness. Okay. Sure, there never could have been a time in which nothing existed. But that doesn't mean there's a single necessary being. It's the cosmic popcorn machine. There could never be a time or a place in which nothing exists. Stop right there, skeptic. That phrase, in which, and I'm going to talk about this in Edwards today with the kids. When you say there never could have been a time or place in which nothing existed. So I'll put something there.
Where?
Something where? In what? In which? In what? You're just moving the problem a step back. You actually do believe in a necessary being. You're just calling it nothing. You're just calling it in which. You're assuming that time and place could be that necessary being. But everybody has to assume necessary being. And that's what Hume meant, whether he even knew it or not, by the phrase, the powers or the principles behind locomotion. He knew, because everybody knows that there has to be something necessarily upholding everything. Even intuitively, we know it. The Bible is clear that we have the sense of God. Calvin and others called it the inward sense of God, by which he reveals himself. And we can't articulate, and that's part of the difference between philosophers and non-philosophers, is that degree of articulation. But even a guy as sophisticated as Hume, who's trying to deny it, is asserting it. Okay? So that's the key. All right, questions, comments, or anything else?